Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. In 1921, a black man in Tulsa, Oklahoma was accused of sexually assaulting a white woman. The charge sparked one of the worst riots in U.S. history, which was all but lost to history until publication of Reconstructing the Dreamland by Alfred Brophy, our guest this week on Talking History. And after that, Don B. Cates will be joining us to discuss yet another book on violence whose findings add fuel to the long-standing but still hotly debated question, do guns cause crime? But first, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on December 10, 1898, the Treaty of Paris formally ended the Spanish-American War, and the United States became a world power. The war began as a result of Cuban rebellion against Spanish rule and Spain's brutal response. It was encouraged by U.S. economic interests in Cuba. In 1895, Cuban patriot José Martí took control of the Cuban countryside, and the Spanish responded by herding peasants into armed camps where thousands died. War ravaged the island, and American property and business interests were destroyed in its wake. In the United States, newspaper headlines and public opinion called for U.S. intervention. In the election of 1896, both the Democratic and Republican parties campaigned for Cuban independence, and in 1897, Republican President William McKinley, in his inaugural address, issued a new policy of armed American intervention in the Western Hemisphere when necessary to protect the nation's interests. When, on February 15, 1898, the U.S. battleship Maine exploded in Havana Harbor and it was blamed on Spain, Congress issued a declaration of war. The war lasted only a matter of months. Commodore George Dewey led a quick and decisive U.S. victory over the Spanish in the Philippines, which was followed by the liberation of Cuba. By the Treaty of Paris, Cuba gained its independence, but the United States took possession of the Philippines, Puerto Rico, and Guam. Within a year, it added Hawaii, Wake Island, and Samoa.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, personal letters written in 1915 but only now made public by the American Jewish Archives at Cincinnati's Hebrew Union College tell the story of a man struggling to establish his innocence in the murder of a 13-year-old girl. The man, Leo Frank, wrote to journalist C.P. Connolly, hoping that Connolly's articles would help overturn his conviction. Instead, they polarized the community, some joining forces with the Ku Klux Klan, others helping to form the Jewish Anti-Defamation League. In June 1915, Georgia's governor commuted Frank's death sentence to life in prison, but an enraged mob broke into prison, seized Frank, and lynched him. 71 years later, in 1986, the state of Georgia pardoned him after an eyewitness stepped forward to identify another suspect. And the City Council of Richmond, Virginia, has voted to honor a black man who was hanged for plotting a slave revolt. The resolution calling Gabriel Prosser an American patriot and freedom fighter commemorates the 202nd anniversary of his hanging on October 10, 1800. Dozens of other conspirators were executed as well after two slaves told their masters of the plot in which Prosser called for the killing of whites with weapons made from farm tools. The slaves planned to set fires, commandeer the city arsenal, take the governor hostage, and use the governor to negotiate their freedom. This is Talking History. The alleged sexual assault of a white woman by a black man in Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1921 ignited one of the worst race riots in American history. Before it was over, in less than 24 hours, as many as 300 people, most of them black, were dead. The city's main black neighborhood was burned to the ground, and 6,000 of its residents were sent to detention camps. Talking History's Jim Madison, professor of history at Indiana University, takes up this tragic but nearly forgotten bit of history with his guest, Alfred Brophy.
It's one of the worst riots in American history. For decades, few Americans knew anything about the Tulsa Riot of 1921. It was not a part of our history. My guest today is a scholar who is making this story an American story, a part of our past and our present. He's Alfred Brophy, professor of law at the University of Alabama, and his new book is Reconstructing the Dreamland, The Tulsa Riot of 1921, Race and Reparations and Reconciliation, published in 2002 by Oxford University Press. Welcome, Al Brophy.
Good to be with you, Jim.
Let's begin with a description of what happened in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in 1921.
I think the story actually of the riot starts on the afternoon of May 30th, 1921, when a 19-year-old African-American man got out of an elevator in an office building in downtown Tulsa. He'd gone in the elevator to use the segregated bathroom facilities in the building, and as he was getting out of the elevator, it seems, as best we can reconstruct now, that he tripped and fell on Mary Page, who was a young white woman who worked as the elevator operator. Nobody thought much about it at the time, but the next day the police and the Tulsa Tribune got a hold of the story, and Dick Rowland was arrested. And then the Tulsa Tribune, the afternoon newspaper, ran a story on its front page talking about Rowland's arrest and alluding to an attempted rape. And that's really what sort of set Tulsa ablaze, as one black newspaper said.
Well, let's get a point of fact in here, Al. The best evidence now is that there was no rape or attempted rape. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, that's sort of one of the many tragedies of the riot is the story was blown way out of proportion. And as far as we can tell now, basically what happened was Rowland tripped as he was getting out of the elevator and fell onto Mary Page, and that's what sort of set everybody on edge.
And so what did they do?
So the afternoon newspaper hits the street about 4 o'clock on May 31st, 1921, and immediately people begin, both in the black and white communities, to think about the possibility of lynching.
Why did they think about the possibility of lynching?
Well, there had been a number of lynchings actually in Oklahoma at the time, and this is lynching was an important part of American, particularly Southwestern American culture at the time. There had been a couple of lynchings on the same weekend about 8 months before in Oklahoma, one of a black man in Oklahoma City, and the black newspapers in throughout Oklahoma talked at the time about the need to be vigilant about protecting against lynching. The Tulsa Star, the black newspaper in Tulsa, said the proper time to afford protection to a prisoner is before the lynching occurs and not after it happens. And when there's a threat of lynching, it is your legal right, indeed duty, to arm yourself and march in a body to the jail, apprise the sheriff of your purpose there, and take life if necessary to uphold the law. Right. They're thinking about using violence to protect against lynching.
And so what do black folks do?
Okay. So the folks down in Greenwood, the black section of Tulsa, get very agitated. They're really concerned. There's a meeting at the Tulsa Star, the black newspaper, and they're heatedly discussing, what are we going to do next? A group of veterans from World War I get together, and about 7 o'clock in the evening, they go down about the mile across the railroad tracks from Greenwood into White Tulsa, show up at the courthouse, and say, we're here to protect our brother Dick Rowland. At that point, the Tulsa police say, we've got everything under control, please go home, although at that point there's already a mob of 300, maybe 400 white people there. So, right, people in both black and white Tulsa are thinking about lynching and the danger of lynching. The veterans go back across the railroad tracks into Greenwood, but they continue to be very concerned about what's going to happen. Around 9, maybe closer to 10 o'clock in the evening, another contingent comes down from Greenwood. And at this point, the police try and disarm the veterans. They come to one person described in newspaper as a dark-skinned man who had come back from the war in France with exaggerated notions of social equality and thinking he can whip the world. They try to disarm him. He refuses to give up his gun, and at that point, shots are fired, and in the parlance of the times, all hell breaks loose.
So how does this beginning of an episode then evolve into the riot that we now know?
Okay, so you've got, at this point, you've got this shots fired down in White Tulsa in front of the courthouse. And at that point, the veterans head back across the railroad tracks into Greenwood as quickly as they can, and as one of the white newspapers says afterwards, immediately white men appeared with guns and started marching around the courthouse with not saying much, with a fixed determination to put down the uprising, right? Because in the minds of white Tulsans, this is a Negro uprising.
In your book, Al, Reconstructing the Dreamland, you make a great deal about the Tulsa police. What are they doing at this time, and what do they do in the hours that follow?
Jim, the Tulsa police are central to understanding both the reason, the way the riot unfolds, and the case for reparations afterwards. The Tulsa police, right, are thinking along with everybody else that this is a Negro uprising. Right? There are no African Americans on the Tulsa police. And what they want to do, they start working hand in glove with the local units of the National Guard to put down the uprising. Now, it's sort of a complex story at this point. What they begin to do is deputize dozens. There's a report by the police chief afterwards that they deputized about 250 white men. They then issued them guns, which they obtained from the local gun shops and pawn shops, and began to execute a plan to take every African American person into what they later called protective custody. And throughout the night, there's sporadic fighting across the railroad tracks that separate white and black Tulsa, Greenwood from White Tulsa. In the early morning hours, they begin to start taking people into protective custody. They bring them to what newspapers call later concentration camps around the city.
But what's wrong with that? What's wrong with taking African Americans into protective custody in this very difficult time?
Well, it's a complex. You put your finger on a very complex issue. The police department afterwards says, "Well, we were trying to protect the Greenwood residents from the mob, and we didn't have enough police officers to protect them from the mob, so what we had to do was get them into a group where they could all be protected." And I certainly see there could be something to be said for that, but I think you can contrast sort of how the police department reacts when they think, how they react to the veterans coming across the railroad tracks and to the white mob that's now angry about the riot.
So what does the white mob do then in this context?
So there's stories, like there's a rumor that 500 black men are coming from Muskogee, which is a town near Tulsa, as reinforcements. There's no evidence that that's true, but that's the rumor. The police department at that point orders a machine gun crew put on the road from Muskogee with instructions to stop these armed men at all hazards. So you've got these, when there's going to be an invasion of African Americans, we put a machine gun crew with orders to shoot. When we think there's a white mob, or when we're trying to put down the uprising, the actions of the police department are to take people into protective custody. So you've got this fighting going on across the railroad tracks throughout the night, and then in the early morning hours of June 1st, they start to execute this plan to take people into custody. The riot really starts to take off about 5 o'clock in the morning, just about dawn. The police department, the local units of the National Guard, in conjunction with the special deputies, start to cross the railroad tracks, making their way into Greenwood and arresting lots of people. That's where I think the story becomes really tragic, because once people have been disarmed and then the buildings have been depopulated, special deputies, along with some uniformed police officers, come along and begin looting and then burning Greenwood.
So there's a massive property destruction. You have some wonderfully tragic photographs in your book of the extent of that property destruction in Greenwood. But there's also a loss of life. How many people died?
That's an excellent question, and it's one we're probably never going to get a complete answer to. The estimates at the time, the official death toll at the time was about 39 people, about 25 of those African American. We know that figure is low. The person in charge of the National Guard said afterwards that the first order of business was restoring order and cleaning up Greenwood. It was not counting bodies. And we're quite certain there were a number of people buried who were not included in that official estimate. Newspaper reports at the time put the death toll somewhere between 80 and 150. And there are, it's a figure we're never going to know the full number, but there were, even according to the low official estimates, about 40 people, and probably substantially more than that.
Okay, so we have massive destruction of property and loss of life. Let's move to the present, Al. What is to be done? Should there be some kind of reparation, some kind of apology, some kind of recompense?
Well, I certainly think that there should be something should be done to try and make the victims of this riot whole. There has been, the Oklahoma legislature established a commission in 1997 to investigate the riot, try and come up with a fuller history of it than we've had before, and also to make recommendations about reparations. As a result of that commission, the Oklahoma legislature last year passed an act acknowledging the riot, and there is a movement afoot in Tulsa to raise some private money for reparations. So I think there's a strong case that can be made for reparations to the, at least to the survivors. There's still about 100 or so people who were alive in 1921 who were victims of the riot. And I think that there's a whole series of factors that suggest reparations are appropriate in this instance, right? We hear a lot about talk of reparations for slavery, and it's a very complex issue. I think the case for Tulsa, reparations for Tulsa, is a much easier one to make for a whole bunch of reasons. One is that there was substantial governmental culpability in this. I think if the police department hadn't deputized the members of the mob that the evening of May 31st, 1921, there probably wouldn't have been, we wouldn't be talking now because there wouldn't have been a major riot.
Yeah.
Finally, the riot ended when out-of-town units of the National Guard came to town. They made it around noon on June 1st and restored order. And the person in charge of the out-of-town units of the National Guard said, one of the worst problems we had in restoring order was with the special deputy. They were, in fact, the worst part of the mob.
Right.
Secondly, there are people still alive, right? A lot of people say, well, reparations for slavery is a complex issue. There aren't any people who are still alive. We still have this human connection between 1921 and the present. The harm is concentrated in time and place, right? This isn't a claim for general societal reparations. And I think, perhaps most importantly, there were promises at the time to help rebuild Greenwood. A number of people in Tulsa said, Tulsa weeps at this unspeakable tragedy, and we will make good the damage so far as can be done to the last penny.
So there's reparations talk even in 1921, though not realized then.
There was some talk about reparations and talk about, at least among some people in white Tulsa, about helping to rebuild Greenwood. There was also talk, though, by the mayor about turning Greenwood into a new industrial site. They wanted to expand the railroad yard. Greenwood was right next to that. And the mayor passed a zoning ordinance that prohibited rebuilding in Greenwood unless you used fireproof material, which essentially made it prohibitive to rebuild there. And then I was quoted in the newspaper saying, well, what I really want to do is relocate Greenwood, the African-American section, about a mile further north away from the center of Tulsa. And one of the reasons he gave was to get more distance between the races.
Right.
Now,
I'm sorry, we're running out of time here, Al, but that's a wonderful connection again, as this entire book is, between past and present. I want to thank you for this wonderful opportunity to do that. Our guest today has been Alfred Brophy, who's the author of Reconstructing the Dreamland, The Tulsa Riot of 1921, Race and Reparations and Reconciliation. Thank you, Al.
Thank you very much.
I got swinging, I got turns, I got holes, I got a...
Welcome back. Continuing on our subject of race and violence in America, Joey Skidmore calls to your attention a new exhibit dedicated to one aspect of that subject, lynching.
In cooperation with Emory University, the Martin Luther King Jr. National Historic Site in Atlanta, Georgia, is hosting a photographic history of lynching in America. Scholars involved in the exhibit say that while the history of lynching is no secret, the purpose of the exhibit is to elicit more research and public discussion. Although most lynchings happened between the 1890s and the 1920s, the practice began in the 1870s, continuing on into the 1960s. Approximately 5,000 people are known to have been victims, but many believe the exact number to be much higher. Its causes, the exhibit suggests, are complex. The photographs, some of which were snapped by people in the lynch mobs, others by reporters, were hardly stowed away in secret. Many were turned into postcards and disseminated widely. People wrote messages on the back of these cards, sending them to friends and family members through the U.S. mail. In a postcard from 1916, depicting the lynching of a 17-year-old mentally retarded black youth in Waco, Texas, the sender refers to last night's barbecue. Without sanctuary, lynching photography in America, at the Martin Luther King Jr. National Historic Site in Atlanta, Georgia, closes on December 31st. Finally, we turn to our weekly commentary. Do guns cause violence? It's one of the most hotly debated questions in America, one of the most violent countries among the developed nations of the world. Studies on the subject abound, but most focus on the American experience. So when a new book appeared on guns and violence in England, Don B. Cates just had to comment. Cates is a criminologist and constitutional lawyer who was taught at Stanford and authored three books on constitutional and criminological issues surrounding gun ownership.
Harvard University Press has published a book on the history of English gun laws saying widespread gun ownership does not cause crime. The author, historian Joyce Malcolm, finds that in the Dark Ages before there were guns, murder rates were high all across Europe. Murder steadily decreased thereafter as guns became more widespread. By the early 20th century, England had no gun control and almost no murder. In 1920, England adopted a strict licensing system for owners of handguns or rifles. This was not for fear of crime, but for fear of revolution. English gun control has become ever stricter. Today, handguns are illegal, and so are most rifles and shotguns. No one may have a gun for self-defense, and self-defense itself is effectively illegal. A 76-year-old farmer is serving life for shooting two burglars who broke into his home. As gun control tightened, crime increased. Today, believe it or not, England's violence rates are worse than ours. People are so afraid that England is suspending civil liberties, including double jeopardy. If a jury acquits a man, the prosecution can just try him again until a jury convicts him. Professor Malcolm's book does not claim more guns made crime go down or fewer made it go up. There may be other factors. But contrary to those who say guns cause crime, ever greater gun ownership did not prevent the crime decline. Her findings are supported by a federal government survey of felons in prisons across America. Two-thirds said they and their friends are afraid that victims may have guns. Your neighbors having guns helps you by making it less likely that you will encounter a burglar or mugger, by turning criminals to non-violent crimes like shoplifting and breaking into closed stores. The felons most afraid of crime, or of victims, came from the states having the most gun ownership. Since the 1970s, many states have allowed honest people to carry concealed handguns, and violent crime went down in those states, but not in states that restrict guns. In fact, restrictive states have the highest violent crime rates, because only the honest people obey their laws. Data from the U.S., England, Canada, and Switzerland show that areas that have the most guns have the least crime.
You've been listening to Don B. Cates, criminologist and constitutional lawyer. Cates' commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Network. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions for future programs, either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, University of Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Information about the OAH and Talking History is available at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.